50. Today is Friday, March 4th, 2016. This is the State Board Performance Framework Study Session commencing at 2 p.m.
Well, we just start the study session. I think we need to be very formal. So. Okay. All right, are we ready?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. All right. You want to start?
Yeah, okay. So thank you all. I know it's Friday afternoon after a really long week. We really appreciate your time being here today. What we really wanted to do, first let me do introductions. So you know me. Marie Hutchins worked at CDE for almost 8 years now. Long time. Helped with the first iteration of the performance framework, built them with Elena. The two of them really did all that work. So they have a lot of history and a lot of knowledge of different ways you could do this.
I can't understand her.
Okay. Sorry, Pam. Is that any better? That's because we have microphones and telephone things, and I was talking into the microphone.
There you go.
I will slow down.
This is it, Shuffle. I'm here too. Thanks.
Thank you.
Pam, will you just let me know if you can't hear me okay?
You sound great right now. Thanks.
Okay. Sounds good. So Marie and Elena is with the Center for Assessment Design, Research and Evaluation through the University of Colorado at Boulder. Previously, she was at the Center for Assessment based out of New Hampshire. That's helped us with the growth model and the performance frameworks for years. You guys want to say anything?
No, that's good.
Yeah. So our goals for today. First, we want to just review what your role is in the process of target setting. We want to describe some possible methods for setting expectations in the performance frameworks. Discuss the challenges and advantages of each of those, and then really have time to answer your questions so we can get a sense of which direction you'd like to go in and if there's additional work you'd like us to do to bring back to you so you feel comfortable making a decision about the target. We made, Maria and Elena especially, dug in and made a very detailed PowerPoint so that you could have all your questions answered and we had reference. We do not need to get into that level of detail if you all do not want to. We just wanted to have it there available for you if you wanted that kind of information.
That's great.
Can I ask a foundation question?
Sure.
So, really, the statute 2211-201 says the board shall annually review the performance of statewide public education, and then follow the review, set statewide targets. Did we do this last year? For some reason, my memory's failing.
It's not failing. We usually do this in November of every year. So, but the last time we did it with the board was November of 14 because we didn't have 15 targets, and we didn't do it in November because we were waiting to finalize and get all the final assessment data out. So now that we have that data, we wanted to bring it to you so we could think about so you didn't forget anything.
Yeah.
And in the past, the board reaffirmed the targets every year. They didn't change from the first year of the performance frameworks. We brought the same targets forward. We held it steady so that we could see change in the system over time.
And which, can you tell me which tests or measures which these standards apply?
Absolutely. And we can go through it, but it's all
if I'm asking questions you're going to cover later, then let's...
Look, it's the next slide. It's perfect.
Okay.
So really what we're talking about today is where this red circle is. This is a screenshot from the school or a district performance framework. I know it's really hard to see, but we're talking about the specific small little targets for academic achievement is this first part up here, and for the different content areas. This is the old one, so there's reading separate from writing, math and science, and then academic growth and all the content areas and English language proficiency. And then this picture doesn't have the post-secondary workforce readiness targets on it, but those are graduation rate, dropout rate, and currently the composite ACT score.
And those are the high schools only?
Those are the high schools and the districts.
I'm on the next slide.
So it's all of these targets specifically that we're going to talk about. You can see the ones for elementary and middle, and then all of them for high school. And the ones with the green new are that we have new assessments in that area, or it's a new measure with the matriculation rate. That's the new measure.
But you didn't say what slide we're on.
Oh, I'm sorry. And Jonathan reminded me we didn't have the
slide. Slide 6.
Oh,
So, but just to clarify back on slide five, we're not today talking about the targets for determining what color or what level rating a school or district has. Those are another set of targets. So all of these points in here from the detail get added up together and we calculate a percentage of targets earned. After that, that percentage is applied to another kind of rubric where we decide if that's a turnaround rating, if it's priority improvement rating, if it's improvement performance, or for district's distinction. Oh, this keeps jumping on me. So that, we'll have that conversation with you all at another time. Like, we'll want to do that next, but right now we want to do the detail ones because we're working on informational reports for school districts to have this spring. So they can just get a sense of what the data looks like, what the new frameworks might look like, and kind of build out their capacity with the work. We're not intending to put overall ratings on for the spring reports. They're just informational. There's no accountability from the 2015 data, so we don't need to have an overall decision. But in the future, you know, in the coming months and over the summer, we'll need to decide what you want those cut scores to be, what the cutoff is for turnaround, for priority improvement, for improvement, performance, and distinction. So that's something that'll come. That actually is, as technical as this is, that probably will be more difficult in terms of policy to do. Like we said, these are the targets we're going to set. Recommendations, we've been talking with our accountability work group, of which we have a few members here today in the audience, and collected feedback across the state over the fall. And there was a recommendation from all that not to include social studies in the achievement targets right now. Use it as a request to reconsider, and then they can submit supplemental information to us, but not include it as an automatic inclusion just because schools are taking it on a rotating basis. And so you may not have the most up-to-date information. And then we're trying to determine the availability of PSAT scores, choices here for all assessment questions you all may have today. But that, with the timing of that, we'll decide whether it makes sense to get them into the frameworks or if it'll delay the framework release or what we'll do with PSAT.
Are they still going to be given in the fall rather than the spring?
PSAT?
For 10th, yeah.
No, the PSAT is going to be given this spring.
This spring. And so will it change to spring, or will there still be a fall version for the kids who are applying for...
So we are administering the PSAT 10, which will be given in the spring, and that's planned on an ongoing basis. There's also the PSAT NMSQT, which is the National Merit Scholarship Qualifying Test, which is given in the fall. So what we know, at least some schools and districts are doing, is they're going to use the PSAT 10 results to inform some of their tutoring of students.
Okay.
Prior to them having to take that high stakes test for them
right. In
the fall.
And they still have to pay for that.
So that is still paid for through normal means. We are working with College Board to be able to, so that College Board will actually offer a discount to Colorado's schools and districts.
Okay.
Pam or Deb, do you guys have any questions so far? Okay, so what we want to talk about next are the possible methods for determining those specific cut scores for achievement and growth and post-secondary workforce readiness in the frameworks. So there's three major ideas. We gave you all a handout today, too, that kind of has it laid out a little bit more. First main methodology is doing norm reference. Right? You set some criteria, like you look according to the distribution of the population, how people are doing, and you say the 50th percentile is the benchmark, and you can pick different other percentiles to do. We'll get into details on each of these. You could do criteria reference. So, for example, for our ACT cut score for exceeds right now, what we have in the frameworks, that was set based on the entrance requirements for four-year colleges at 22. So that's a criteria reference that we base that on. And then there's also been a suggestion about keeping previous targets, so we want to just talk about that idea of what that would look like, too, if we kept the ones that previously were in the framework. So we talked norm and criteria already. I'm going to turn it over to Marie now, and she's going to talk through the normative approach and how we could do it. There, as you see on this paper, it gets into some details about 4 different options for doing norm. This is where we can get really, really weedy, or we can stop and just talk high level. So you all let us know. We'll do the high level stuff first. If you want to keep going deeper, we can do that. If you're done and want to move on, we're happy to do that too. So just give us an indication of what you'd like.
So sort of to again frame what a norm reference target setting looks like. So the idea that you set standards on a distribution of scores that sort of define where the unit of interest, in this case a particular school, is located relative to a comparison group, so all schools in Colorado. And I've heard that this is the slowest turtle analogy. This is that situation where, you know, you're looking at your population of turtles and saying, well, you were third from the front, so that is something that has meaning to you. And really we're indicating how well a system is performing in comparison to other systems that we've deemed equivalent. And this method sort of explicitly bases our value judgments on the observed performance of Colorado students, schools, and districts. And this is what we have previously used to set our achievement growth and a lot of the dropout rate performance targets on the prior performance frameworks. And so I go into a lot of detail. I live in the weeds, so let me know if you guys don't want to come and learn that much detail with me. But just to let you know how we sort of operationalize this, you know, when we have the assessments, they sort of create a normal curve when you look at the average scale scores, and then we have turned those or converted them into percentile ranks. Because somehow, you know, when you have a test score that goes from 650 to 850, that doesn't have any inherent meaning, and people have a hard time interpreting that. But when we say 1 to 99, people have some experience with that, and it's a little more intuitively obvious for them. So we kind of transform everything that we're doing into percentile ranks. And then thus far what we have done is we have set expectations on those percentile ranks, saying that the 15th percentile is where you have to be to get an approaching rating. Anything below the 15th is considered not meeting expectations. So then at the 15th, you're approaching expectations. If you get to the 50th percentile, now you're meeting state expectations. And then the 85th percentile is sort of exceeding state expectations. And so this is kind of the slide that I show the color coding that we have tended to use with the frameworks to give people a really sort of quick, clear, you know, visual signal as to whether their results are, you know, in need of improvement or if they're somehow, you know, astounding. And so we also have, just for your information, sort of the meets expectations at the 50th percentile, that is pretty much average results for the state. The approaching expectations cut is about one standard deviation below, and then the exceeds cut is about one standard deviation above. And the intention of this really is to differentiate among the performance of our schools. So we really can say, you know, these are our highest flyers, sort of our average schools, and then sort of our lower performers that we want to look at. Yeah, that.
But 84% is closer to 85%. So how could you say that somebody at the 84th percentile is meeting expectations and just one point above exceeds expectations?
So that is the whole point of a norm in a lot of ways. It winds up admittedly setting a kind of arbitrary bar that we have determined that the performance from 50th to 84th percentile is meeting our expectations. And then because we're looking for a certain number of schools or districts to identify as exceeding expectations, that becomes sort of that 85th to 100 bucket. It is true that, like, when you're looking at the difference between 84 and 85, there's not necessarily a lot of meaning to that. But that's the thing about a normative system, is you're trying to identify a certain number of systems as being exceeds or as being does not meet.
Okay. If it's that arbitrary, I call that arbitrary, then I would just give it the percentile and leave it at that, and then do that so that people can say, well, you know, it's 74, so that leads to expectations somewhere to the side. Because it's really, it doesn't seem very fair.
So then what's the 83rd percentile? And then you sort of, then the 82nd and the 81st, like this always becomes a slippery slope that you have to at some point decide that you're just going to set a cut score. And at least that's what we have done in the past. It's either that or we have some options for some of the criterion reference
Well, yeah. But I think it's important to know, too, that when you're using a criterion reference approach, you still have to make a determination of what the cut is. So there's always a cut, and there's always going to be people below the bar, people above the bar, and that's the part that's a little bit, there's going to be some policy decisions that need to be made about that. But yeah, your concerns are absolutely valid.
Well, I wouldn't even have criterion reference. I would just have a norm reference and give the percentile score.
Are you saying, like, add up the percentile rank? So say, so instead of determining if it's a does not meet, meets, approaching, or exceeds, you just say they're at the 12th percentile and the 14th percentile and the 16th percentile and the 28th percentile, and we'll add up all those, and that gives us a number, and we use that number to roll up to an overall rating. Is that what you think? Like, because at some point, the way our system is now, because we have to have an overall rating at the end of this, we need some way of saying it's good enough or it's not good enough. We can't just have one number on withdrawal.
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Yes.
Are you asking now whether or not we have to identify buckets? In other words, are you saying can we just report percentile ranks?
That's right. That's what I'm asking.
And are you saying, is it Alyssa who's speaking, I guess?
Yes, it was.
You know, are you saying that we have to have categories and buckets, or are there other ways to think about those buckets? I mean, I'd need to go back and revisit the statute. What does it precisely say we have to do for an overall rating?
I think the statute is explicit that we need an overall rating at the end. In the statute it says the levels that schools or districts need to be assigned to. I think the way that we've divvied it up to try and give schools and districts an indicator of how their performance is in terms of reading achievement or English language achievement, and then achievement overall, and then growth, and the individual growth measures and growth overall, is having created some of those categories of performance. But I don't think that is inherent in law, that it needs to be done that way.
It's not, but a lot of our unified improvement planning has been built around sort of the problem with the 15th percentile or the 14th or the 50th is there's not an inherent value judgment for that. And by doing these cuts, we're sort of adding, this is something that you should be paying attention to because it is worrisome. Yeah. Or this is something that you should be celebrating because it is impressive. So in general, sort of putting these ranges that are implying, a value about that, like that's the purpose for that. And we're using that for our improvement planning process. So I think regardless, we would have to set some ranges of concern and then some range of percentile ranks that would indicate high performance as well.
Well, obviously, an 84 percentile is high.
Yeah.
A 15 percentile is low.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I think people can figure out that. And I just don't think that when you have an 82nd percentile at the almost meets expectations?
Meets or exceeds? It's almost to exceed. I see what you're saying. That's a really good suggestion.
Is there a range for the buckets? Like what you're saying is you can give percentile range, but ultimately you have to group them meaningfully, put them in a bucket, and label the bucket. When we think of the score for the buckets on the top and on the floor and the ceiling of that bucket, is there like an error measure or a range that determines where that line gets drawn, or is it just a bright line, and if you're 1 point under it, so it's too bad, if you're 1 point over, it's good for you? And what's on either side of the line?
So actually, I'm going to let Elena answer that question. We've been having that conversation.
You can certainly build in a standard error around the cut score itself. That's certainly a possibility, and that's something that could be explored.
So what's a standard deviation? How many points? Up or down?
Well, you'd have to actually investigate that.
Okay.
In this particular case, one standard deviation gets you to the 15th and 85th percentiles.
But that's not the error around the cut
score. But that is not the error around the cut score. You're absolutely right. Like, so if you're looking for confidence intervals, that is a different conversation. And the problem that we usually have with the confidence intervals is we have systems that are of vastly different sizes. So technically, confidence intervals should really take into consideration sort of how large the system is to determine, you know, if the difference between an 84 and an 85 is meaningful or if it's not. And we have had a lot of conversations with our technical advisory panel about sort of doing confidence intervals and sort of doing some of those N-weighted measures. And there are a lot of technical and messaging challenges involved in doing those different approaches.
And I think I just want to emphasize the messaging challenges. I think the communication of that becomes a little difficult. So I think that was a sticky point, especially in terms of the technical advisory panel, to consider implementing that because of having to go to all the districts and schools and explain what those error bands consist of and why. That was certainly a challenging issue.
Now think about explaining it to the districts and then explaining it to each individual parent.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing to think about, the frameworks, while they stand on their own, they're also part of a request. There's a request to reconsider process. So if schools and districts are feeling like the framework doesn't accurately represent their performance, they're able to bring additional evidence forward. When we do that process, a lot of what we look at is how close they are to those cut points. And see, if you're a school and you're consistently at the 80th or above percentile, you're almost to the 85th, and we've got some additional evidence that shows you there, that's something we take into consideration, and that determines the overall rating afterwards when we do that request to reconsider process. So that's a way we can take it into consideration. I think we can go back and look at your suggestion, Val. I think it's a really interesting idea to think about. I think we also want to think about how it interacts with the Every Student Succeeds Act, with ESSA, because that requires some targets, but I need to look and see if those targets are required in the accountability itself or if it's something you report or how that fits in. But I think there's some investigation we could go do into that.
And I think from my perspective, and I think from all of our perspectives, right, we hear a lot about the fairness factor of this. I mean, what I hear is that psychometrically there are issues with where the cut scores get set and that, you know, with a small N for some districts that one or two kids could have made the difference between in one bucket or another bucket. And I mean, I don't know, whatever we can do to really uncover fairly what's going on so that it's meaningful, helpful information, but not just sort of arbitrary. Not that it would be arbitrary, but it could be partially arbitrary if we don't look deeply into what those numbers represent.
ESSA, technically, tell me if I'm wrong, it really, after this year, starting in 17, 18, the only obligation we have to our UIP right now is for the next year. So how does this, and this is where messaging, I mean, messaging is being incredibly tricky. How do we talk to districts and communities now after this year? I mean, we're going to have a message this coming year, but we're still tied in with UIP habits and thinking. That's going to go away in essence. It's going to look different than it does now. So how, I guess the idea is, there can't be two pathways to this, part of it normed and part of it criterion. How do we coagulate this message for people? I don't see a problem. I see the advantages of the text. So I'm just concerned about us getting too deep into UIP and ignoring the long term on this a little bit. But the other part of it is, the percents, I don't know, you look at this, and a lot of us are old enough to go, ooh, bell curve, thought we got away from it, I know, we don't want to promote that too much, but it's still in the head, and so then when you attach percentage ranges to that, this is where the well and A is 90 to 100, a B is 80 to 89, whatever, we go back to the traditional letter grade types of scales. And how is that these days? How is that received these days? I don't know. This one is actually kind of, this one resonated more with me. To grab it this way, but even then it was like, well, how do you cut a point? Where do you put the point so that you have a pretty clear delineation of what still needs to be done? And this is where my UIP thinking comes in. What's the incentive for, there will always be incentives, districts will always find their goals, but it's just going to be different. I agree there has to be some sort of a point. I also agree that from 30 to 84, whatever that one rate is, it's huge. There are 34 points difference between between approaching and meets, and from does not meet to approaching. So that's a
yeah. Yes. I know you don't like the bell curve, but it is kind of that idea that, like, the majority of our schools and districts sort of fall in that middle sort of approaching and meets. And then you have sort of the two tail ends that are more extreme that we feel that we can actually sort of differentiate a little bit more. And the idea with the way the whole system works is that in any one particular metric, sort of that bell curve is not that meaningful, but when you have a whole bunch of those metrics added together, the systems that consistently pop as being extreme sort of become more and more extreme, and you really get to see that they do function very differently from the majority of your, you know, school and district population. And that, at least based upon what we've previously done with the performance frameworks, has been what we've been really trying to identify, is particularly the systems that are at the very bottom end that really needs something significant needs to happen to shift their performance. And so being able to have sort of just those extreme tails is kind of how we went about building a system that could identify the bottom 5% as turnaround and the next 10% as priority improvement.
Which I know the accreditation conversation is kind of separate, but it's really hard to separate them totally and start thinking about what is the final message and perception that's created by them. And when we get into that conversation, I'm still going to come back to my, so what is credited with improvement? Let another day.
Yes. So some from a technical perspective, like, it's kind of trying to build a system that allows us to differentiate so that when we do have that conversation, we can say something meaningful about what does it look like to be accredited with improvement.
If we can go through a little bit more, just kind of talk about big ideas in here, and then we can go back, stop whenever you guys want, have more conversation. This is probably an important topic to talk about.
Yes. So just so you know that we have been, previously we had baselined the targets that we set. So baselining is the process of sort of setting expectations on the current year and then holding future years to those same expectations so that we're not recalculating the targets every single year. And so the important part about baselining is that it allows systems to show improvement over time. And so with the previous frameworks, we had baselined them using 2009 and 2010 data.
Because, was that the first
year? That was the first year. Or it was the first year we did the performance frameworks.
Okay.
So it was at that time, that was the current year. And it was maybe CSAC even at the time.
But at least it had been given for a while.
Exactly.
Yes. Exactly. So we are kind of supposing, at least right now, because we do have new assessments, we do need to reset all of our baselines and sort of set them using this 2014-15 data, with the caveat that we will probably have to revisit them once we have a second year of PARC data available, maybe even a third, depending on, you know, what we see in terms of consistency of our PARC results over time. And then just in general with sort of baselining, you do have to occasionally re-examine and renorm those targets just because your systems shift and you want to make sure that you maintain the meaning of your accountability system. So it's kind of, you have a periodic process of revamping them. And this was a good opportunity for us, obviously, with the transition to revamp.
So what, Lauren Shepherd will say about assessments is that there is always, almost always, a growth in year one and year two, or year one and year two, year three, because of the nature of the assessment. So we're hanging out a little bit by using, I wouldn't have a choice.
Yeah.
But we are kind of hanging out, and I think we should make that pretty important consideration.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're going to tell ourselves next year, wow, when in fact the wow is about greater familiarity with this kind of assessment as opposed to dramatic increase in student learning.
Yeah.
And I don't know, is there a time period? Is it the second time you take the test? Is it the third time you test? What is the best time to be using it as a baseline?
I think it's a fair question, and I think you are absolutely right that as we're looking at some of the changes we expect to see between year and two, some of it's going to be just pure familiarity with the test, right? The different kinds of question types. In our case, we also have the technology issues. After year three, I would suggest that now you're seeing true change in terms of student achievement.
So year three would probably be an appropriate time to say maybe this, especially if that baseline is dramatically different than what we pick now.
Just reading reports on the technology, you make it as if it's not very important, but people who took the paper and pencil test say that, you know, there was a huge difference between people who took paper and pencil and people who took it online.
Right, and now we've got districts going back. Districts that took online last year are now going back to paper and pencil. So I think that is, you're right. I think it is a big issue.
Yes.
But just the nature of the test.
Just as a point of clarification, there are obviously a lot of conversations about are there differences in terms of mode. For Colorado, we did not have the same issues that other states had, in part because for grades 4 through 11, the only students we allowed to take the assessment on paper were our students with disabilities and our English learners, again, in English language arts, and that's one of the areas where other states actually saw paper outperforming online. Colorado did not see that.
Because they didn't have that option. But now, when we get to year three, we probably need to look at what is still going on.
No, it's not the case with Denver. Not the case with Denver. Denver had much fewer people. There are a lot more kids in Denver that are English second language learners, and there were very few kids who took paper and pencil test in Denver.
Very few kids took it last year. Solid as a whole, very few this year with that option. I'm hearing about districts that are changing from
So I think the intention is that sort of with this first year of data, we'll set what targets we can, and then for the next couple of years, we will reinvestigate them and then decide when the appropriate time to actually set that permanent baseline that we want to use moving forward is going to be. And then there's also sort of this other future consideration in that the federal legislation from the Every Student Succeeds Act requires states to set long-term goals. And then including measures of interim progress for all of our accountability indicators. I will say that the Secretary is limited on prescribing what those specific long-term goals are and how we want to do those interim measures, but there is a pretty clear expectation that we must increase our performance over time. So we've been having a lot of conversations about how to do this in a way that is, ideally integrated into a single system instead of having sort of separate AYP targets and separate state targets, like if there's a way that we can make these sort of mesh together. And so my proposal, at least, is sort of using the norm distributions to create targets based on Colorado data and then increase them incrementally over time, sort of compared to that initial baseline, so that we can ensure that our, you know, Colorado can have ambitious yet attainable long-term goals.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Do we take into account the infusion of refugee kids when we look at what valence we're going to give growth versus static targets and how those change over time? In other words, the population of some of the schools is changing pretty systematically with a certain percentage of kids coming from countries where they even, some of them don't have a stable written language, and you know, some of the needs of the kids are very substantial. So I'm wondering how that figures into how we think about these targets.
So in general, we've been looking at is when we set the individual targets on, say, you know, reading, or actually now it's English language arts for elementary school, we're setting it on the entire elementary school population. There's not different targets for different subgroups of students. In ESSA, the feds are pretty clear that they do, from my reading, they expect all students to be held to the same set of expectations. But then when it comes into how we decide we want to weight achievement versus growth, that we do have quite a bit of latitude in making those decisions.
So can we set, when we think of the overall student population in Colorado versus some districts which have more refugee, just more needy kids than others, can we set the valence different between static achievement and growth in different districts, depending on their demographics, or does it have to be the same for all the districts?
It has to be a single set of expectations applied to all schools and districts in the state.
Right. So that means we'd have to be looking at those percentages and averaging them and using that to inform the valence or, you know, relative weight of either achievement or growth, right? And are we doing that?
I would say that the deciding how we want to weight achievement and growth is a future conversation that we're going to have with this group. It's once we've decided on sort of these individual components, we'll get to figure out how we want the whole system to add together and what we want the outcomes to look like.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, just, you know, there's some flexibility and probably not enough for students that have come without any formal education, but there is some flexibility for testing for recently arrived English learners that come from out of the country for those in their first year. But I know if a kid comes in 11th or 12th grade or 10th grade, even they've never been in school before, that's a very different situation.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So when we're setting goals, or these incremental goals, what we're talking about is hoping to shift this.
Yes.
Expecting the kind of distributions we're accustomed to, but just having this bell curve be moving to the right.
Yes. Ideally, we want the entire population to be shifting up so that we have better performance across all of our students in Colorado. That's our goal.
And I think part of the baselining idea, and granted we've got new assessments, but that idea is so that everybody can improve, that you don't always have this bottom 5%, but you kind of set what these expectations are, and then you leave it so you can show that people are making progress and getting ahead.
Challenge is that when you have a conversation about all kids are going to reach a certain level.
Absolutely.
That's not the conversation we're having.
Depending on how you set your frameworks, yeah. And it's that balance between the feds would love this, and I think it's actually a good phrase, even though it's really hard to define, ambitious yet attainable, right? We want to have ambitious goals, and we want goals that are realistic and that we can attain over time. And that's really hard. With the achievement gaps we have in our state, it's really hard.
But just know, like, for this, you know, future target setting thing, we do have a little bit of time, you know, before ESSA has to be, you know, fully in place. So we can look again at the targets next year once we have a new year's data, and you can think about this a little bit more before setting those expectations.
Okay.
And that's just a real key point. We have time for the ESSA integration. We think state plan will be due sometime next winter, spring, so that 17-18 year will be the year the data is first used for that the fall of 18, those performance frameworks is when we first need to have ESSA fully integrated in there. So we've got time, we've got audibility to think through what's right for our state.
And then we also do get into quite a bit of detail in the PowerPoint about the individual achievement and growth metrics. So starting first, and actually the NPWR, so starting first with the achievement metrics, just sort of an overview. So we're proposing to use mean scale score on the CMAS science and social studies and English science, science only, English language arts and math assessments. And then we'll be setting the targets by grade span, sort of elementary schools are lumped together, middle schools and high schools, and then thinking that we'd use the 15th, 50th, and 85th percentile ranks. And then I always put in the caveat that for schools, that's fine, we generally exclude the alternative education campuses because they have a very different population of students attending them, and it tends to skew the results, it can potentially skew the results for the entire state in a way that's not really meaningful. And then we also remove districts and schools that have less than 16 records just because that's too small for us to report, and they tend to show a lot more volatility than other systems. So it's of the schools that sort of meet all of these criteria, we have historically used the percent of students scoring proficient or advanced on TCAP, so the percent of students scoring at a particular benchmark, but we are now proposing to shift to the mean scale score as our metric for two reasons. One is that the mean scale score allows us to focus on the achievement for all students, not just sort of bubble kids that are near the benchmark cut point. And then also because data can be more accurately reported with a mean scale score compared to a percent proficient metric, and ensures greater data privacy. So the big thing for at least for me is the data privacy concerns, because even when we are requiring a minimum N of 16 using the percent at benchmark, we have potential to identify students' personally identifiable information. Because if a school has 0% of students at benchmark or 100% of students at benchmark, by definition, we know the academic achievement of all of their of every single child in that school. And that is PII. So we're having to reconsider how we look at achievement and status scores. And so we have situations where also where only a small number of students fall into a proficiency category, and then we have to go through these rather arduous masking and suppression algorithms to make sure that we're not disclosing PII. And so what we've done previously, not previously, for this year for the first time, we would have sort of a range. We reported greater than 50% of students at benchmark, because I can't tell you, you know, exactly 52 or 54. And the problem with having a target that you can't actually report is, what did we write on here? So it becomes difficult to report whether or not the school was greater than or less than the target when you can't actually tell them what their actual target value was and what their actual mean scale score was. So with mean scale score, as long as they meet the minimum N criteria, there's no conclusive way to determine an individual student's scale score or performance level, so it gets us around some of these data privacy concerns and some of the difficulties caused by reporting and setting targets.
I know this math is just what you all want to be doing on a Friday afternoon.
I don't
want
to be worried about myself or not. I'm really starting to understand this.
I'm scared. Well, you're the same voice, aren't you?
I don't have a clear number in my head. How many districts do we have that are under 16 in the classrooms? How many districts do we have that are under 16?
So there's only a handful of districts, I would say, that are under 16. But one of the problems that we actually have is this is, it's actually 16 students in elementary taking the assessment, or having valid scores on the assessment, I should say. So a lot of times, even we do have quite a lot of districts that are, you know, a couple hundred, and they have situations where sometimes they fall below this end, and sometimes they have data that's reported or not. It's one of the reasons that for the performance frameworks, we've generally done the three-year aggregations to try to give those small districts more time to accumulate enough student records to be reported. But since we are with the new test and having to start over again, we're kind of back at square one, that we don't actually have additional years. And we're going to have more situations where schools and districts don't meet the minimum end.
So currently, we have the data on the performance of those really small mm-hmm. grade levels, district sizes. What do we do with them now? How do you talk to them now on an annual yeah. basis? You know, and
yeah.
the three-year thing, you know, the three-year
yeah.
mm-hmm. span reporting. Good.
Yeah.
But how do we address needs that keep popping up, no matter yeah. the size of the school or district? I guess, you know, it's kind of rhetorical, but I would like to know how are they interacted
from CDE
and how are we interacting with them? Because if there's a consistent, and even if it's high achieving,
yeah.
you know, yep. either way, but especially the underperforming, and it's, this can go on for 3 years until we really have what. By policy and rule is until we have enough information to really impact.
Yeah, I think it will be a challenge for us this first year when we just have one, you know, we'll have 2 years of data. We'll have to think about if about 15 data if we want to do a two-year framework with the 15 data and the 16 data, or just use 16 as the first year. But it is a challenge, and that's where we also have the request to reconsider process, and we really try and target that for small systems so they can submit additional data and evidence. When we work with them on improvement planning and trying to help them understand their performance, they, you know, sometimes we get frustrated because, understandably so, they're like, well, we don't have these aggregate numbers, we can't do it the way you're telling all these other schools to do it. And at that point, it really becomes, we have some guidance out there for them, it becomes really knowing your students and not writing down about individual students and what kids can do, because we don't want that in a public document. But for them, really, they have the ability to be able to look individually at kids. That I think so much of why we look at aggregate data in larger systems is because it's a quick way to get a big picture understanding, but then you really do want to get to individual kids and know what individual kids can need. It doesn't fit so well into a system built like this, though. So it's trying to figure out those needs.
Again, another day of conversation, but I'd be interested to know sometime, because I don't have those tiny districts in daily life. But how, at what rate are those who are underperforming for a time, at what rate are they asking for help?
Okay.
I mean, are they reaching out for the resources available? Is there some other kind of operation in place where regional, I would bet a lot of them work with BOCES
yes.
mm-hmm. types of resources, but I guess it's the two-way communication thing. Do they know about what they're taking advantage of?
And some are and some aren't, is what I can tell you. Like, we reach out to them and some want to engage and some don't. But that's the same thing with the larger districts, too. Some want to do it, engage more, and some don't as much. So, that's a good question.
Curious.
It is curious.
So then, additional considerations that we have, particularly for this year, is participation. So participation rates from 2014-15 mean that not all students are included in the distributions that were used for setting our norms targets. And the participation rates in the demographics of students who did participate and the elementary and middle school level suggest that we do have pretty representative data for the state as a whole. But participation rates at the high school were lower, and we are not entirely sure that we actually have a representative sample. So this is kind of another reason that we will want to revisit these targets in future years, depending on how the data shakes out in the next round of testing. So we are trying for the spring to release informational reports to the field. that are sort of a preview of what they should be expecting to get next fall, when there is at least currently an expectation that we will be publishing the new performance framework, sort of 2.0. And so to try to get that, you know, these spring preview reports, we have gone through the data from the new assessments, and using this idea of the 15-50-85, you know, set targets for elementary, middle, and high school, you know, and we've shown them here. So if the board is eventually going to, or I should say the board will eventually have to approve some set of targets, and this is, I guess, our first attempt at setting forth actual values for those.
This is one way to do it. This is what 15-50-85 would look like on a norm distribution, on norming on the schools. And so there's some details in on that, but it's just a way to look at where they are. I think it's probably helpful for you all to know, because you don't live and breathe the scale scores of PARC the way we do, but 750 is the benchmark scale score on all assessments. Please interrupt me if I get this wrong. So you can see just with what in the world is happening. I don't know. It just jump. Keeping you guys excited this afternoon. With what's on here, if you looked at, if you wanted a mean scale score that where all kids are on, the mean is at that percent 4 or 5 percent at benchmark, that's about, for English language arts, it's in between the meets and exceeds, but close to the exceeds cut point. And math, it's at exceeds, or a little bit above that, where everybody's at 4 or 5. So it's just trying to take it back to that norm, like if you wanted to think proficiency percentages, what that baseline is. So that probably is quite a confusion. I'm sorry.
Consistency. If I understand that these are the raw score, consistency between elementary, middle, and high.
Yes. So this is actually very different from TCAP. So the TCAP was vertically scaled, which meant that sort of the expectations for a fourth grader could be, you know, a 350. Expectations for a fifth grader could be 500. For a sixth grader could be 550. And so we did see sort of these incrementally increasing targets on TCAP. But the way that they created PARC is that every single grade is 650 to 850 on all the same targets are set at the same places, and sort of they've been standardized to be consistent in that way. So
that's really helpful, isn't it?
It helps so much with interpretation, and it allows us to use this kind of metric because it has meaning across the system.
Makes a whole lot more sense than what we had before.
Yep. So now we can say that a 750 means at benchmark across all of our grades, and that has
so
some kind
of mastery.
We're not
talking about the teachers who set the 8th grade math. There was such weird conversations that I don't think ever.
So I think there were a lot of conversations back in the CSAP standard setting days, and with the CMAS PARC assessments, there were also a lot of conversations. But in the end, where the teachers, educators indicated this is what it means to have mastered the standards at this grade level, that was defined as 750. So the number was assigned based on the recommendations of the teachers. So again, it is very easy to have conversations across the state of Colorado now, as Elizabeth indicated, 750, grades 3 through 9 for ELA and math, that's the target for individual students on the assessment.
And then the 15, 50, and 85 percentiles are also very consistent because sort of the way the schools and districts spell out is pretty consistent.
That's very interesting.
So that is, I'm hoping that will add some value for this next round. So there are some challenges in using norms. And the biggest one is that the comparison group determines where a particular value ranks. So therefore, the decision on who is included or excluded from that comparison group is extremely important. And so the norm reference targets sort of vary greatly depending on whether we look at schools as the comparison group or districts as the comparison group. And this is probably more information than you need. But, you know, we have 182 districts that range in size from 3 students to 90,000 students. And we have 1,851 schools that range in size from 1 to, you know, 4,000 students. So there are a lot fewer districts, and they are a lot more diverse in terms of how their size. So in general, what we've seen when we look at the results for this is that, you know, the districts tend to sort of be a little more clumpy, yet the districts are on the top and the school distribution is on the bottom. So the district tends to it clusters more closely towards the mean, and then the school distribution is a little more spread out. And you can also see that the school distribution, just because there are more schools, sort of allows for more differentiation than the district distribution. And so this is still a thing in discussion, because previously we had set these framework targets independently for schools and districts. So we had one set of targets for schools, one set of targets for districts. Feedback from stakeholders was that this was confusing. A small system could have one set of ratings based upon the district results, and then for identical results, they could have a different set of ratings on the school results. And so we've been trying to figure out a way to solve this issue. And one of the options is to use either the school or the district distribution and just apply the same set of cuts for everything. And so for the presentations that we've done today, just for simplicity of not completely inundating you with results data, we used the school results or the school distribution for all of our comparisons.
Okay, so this is just for elementary.
Yeah. So this paper, this kind of talks about the different norm reference options that you all have. So one is the school distribution, and that works when you do it based on the schools, and the school data is really even. It's got that nice 15, 50, 85, but you don't see that for districts. Kind of the districts are mostly clumped in the middle, right?
We have impact data.
Okay.
So if you want to see two more slides from now. So we actually went through and applying, these targets that we proposed, what would the distribution of ratings for does not meet, approaching, meets, and exceeds look like for each of the elementary, middle, and high school. And then we broke it out by sort of what do the schools look like and what do the district ratings look like. And so you can see that the school ratings, as Alyssa said, sort of closely match the 15, 50, 80 targets, but the district distributions are kind of discrepant, particularly at the exceeds rating. And that is just one of those things that we're going to have to decide what we want to do in terms of which comparison group to apply, because pretty much every option we have has some drawbacks and some negative unintended consequences. So we'll just need to decide what we really want to value in our state. And I have all the data in case anybody wants more data. We did run everything using the district distributions as well, but they wind up looking, 15, 50, 85, the districts are very tight. And then if you apply the district distributions to schools, things get really a little bit wonky. You wind up with a whole lot of schools that does not meet and exceeds sort of extremes. So it's kind of like the districts pull everything in the middle, schools kind of push everything to the extremes. I will also say that the difference between the school and district distributions is the most pronounced for achievement. We're moving into the growth.
Can we stop that?
Yes.
So you could do the school distributions and the district distributions. We didn't make slides. You could do what we used to do with separate school and district distributions. We heard that we've been surveys, we've been out in the field, we've had an accountability work group. Everybody wants those targets aligned, is what we heard really loud and clearly.
Until we do it. And then when we get the,
correct.
As you call it, squirrely or whatever.
Yeah, and then you're looking for weird results. The other thing we could do, and we haven't run impact yet, is you could take the school distribution and the district distribution, and you could cut the difference, and you could make a target somewhere between the school and the district one. It starts getting even more arbitrary. And again, this is if you want to do norms. So if you want to do something different than norm, then you'd have other options. But for norm, those are kind of the four different options we thought through. But they all, none of them are perfect. There's going to be a concern with each of them to some degree or another.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We spent a lot of time trying to brainstorm to see if there was a best option. And in the end, we really have not been able to come up with anything. Luckily.
I think that the more similar it is to how it's been while addressing concerns, the easier it is to explain, because people already have a grounding of what we've done for the last 5 years, or some people do, right?
I was going to say, I don't know that I did.
Okay. Okay. And that's definitely something we've got to figure out, the balance. I got an earful from some, I got concerns shared today that we at CDE shouldn't go with a simplistic, easy to explain methodology if it's not the best methodology. So we're trying to balance that technical exactness and then communicating and making it clear and understandable and fair, because so much of it is about fairness too. Right?
I think fair is the biggie.
Yeah.
I agree with what
I
was
saying.
I think that,
yeah. Gotcha. So the next section we're going to talk about is the growth targets. So this year, the metric that we're looking at doing for the performance frameworks is the median growth percentile, or median student growth percentile. And until we have more consecutive years of CMAS PARC, we sort of suggest holding out on doing adequate growth metrics, because we don't really know what growth from PARC to PARC looks like yet, so we need to wait a little while. And we also have some time to consider how we would potentially want, if and how we would potentially want to include that in the frameworks. And there has been pretty widespread stakeholder input encouraging us to remove adequate growth from the growth indicator as a whole, and the calculations that we're being doing. So,
I think what's happened with adequate growth is defined in statute, and the way it's defined in statute is that they're really ambitious and not so attainable targets for students who, you know, we used to calculate them on unsat and partially proficient. So those students that were unsat and partial, the goal was to get them to proficient within 3 years or by 10th grade. And the targets, the kind of growth needed to get there, especially from the kids that were at unsatisfactory levels, was extremely ambitious, and we didn't see it happening very often. Students that were already proficient in advance, the target is defined in statute is to remain proficient for the next 3 years. That was an extremely attainable target and not very ambitious. So based on the kind of students or the student performance that you had or student achievement in your school, some schools had really high adequate growth that was mirroring what they were already finding out about achievement. And so the conversation was, if we're talking about growth, let growth be pure growth and not be tied to what kind of kids you have, but really be about growth, and then have achievement be that other indicator of whether they where they are or not. I think the adequate growth data, and I think some more nuanced ways of measuring growth to say if it's enough and maybe make it more developmental along the way of getting kids along the stage would be really useful, and that is useful for improvement planning purposes, but for accountability, the way it's defined in statute is really hard right now for it to be a fair and meaningful target there, and a target that really encourages progression over time. We had been able to set the targets with the English language proficiency growth, and that really is about developmental. It's getting from one level of English proficiency to the next, and that reflects what students are doing with a little bit of ambition built in, and that's felt a lot more fair and a lot more meaningful. So,
yeah, the field has been a lot more supportive of those targets, and so whatever we wind up doing with, you know, PARC in future years, I think we're going to take a more nuanced look at it and dig a little bit deeper.
Just thinking here, what are those the conversation, all of the, anything related to growth, achievement, the static versus the moving picture.
Mm-hmm.
We do have, I think I'm right, we have a focus on those conversations around math, English language arts, science. How are those conversations going, I guess, even now, with the non-tested content areas, and tied into how districts and schools set their goals, where's the UIP? I know some of the answers to that, but even that's one group. The other group is, how is growth and goal setting discussed with the subgroups that we have to show data for on all levels, including that's part of, still going to be part of the federal reporting requirement. GT, for example, to get a great deal of growth on in that large group of kids is much different than in bringing them on growth when you're at the lower performing end But even that is complicated because within all the other subgroups, there are a full range of kids as well. But I'm just looking forward to the next couple of years of everything that we're looking at changing to really get some new ways of thinking about those kinds of conversations. And still having a process of our own system be consistent so it keeps its integrity as well. I'm just thinking, we've got a lot of work to do.
We have a lot of work to do.
You know, on the one hand, it's really exciting what could happen. Good stuff. On the other hand,
yes.
All those details.
So many details. And so it turns out that for growth, previously we had had a single set of growth targets that were applied to all content areas and EMH levels. And in looking at the PARC data that we have thus far for this year, we found something similar that we probably could set a single set of cuts that's consistent, which makes it much easier. So we're looking at median growth percentiles of 30, 50, and 65. As sort of producing that 15, 50, 85 percentile rank distribution.
So that's what we had before.
Yes. It was
close.
It was close.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And we had different targets of whether or not they made adequate growth or not adequate growth and all that mess. But the
intention, or at least initially, had been sort of to empirically still get to, at the time it was actually 15, 50, 90, but we heard recommendations to make it symmetrical, so now it's 15, 50, 85. But it's the same idea that it's a single set of growth targets. Applied to all the content areas and all of the grades. And so that's just kind of the explanation that we have, you know, the notes about that. And then to the next slide, you can see that when you look at the impact data for the growth targets for schools and districts, using, this is still one set of targets, but they're very consistent and very similar and very close to sort of that, you know, the top 15% and exceeds, 35% meets, 35% approaching, bottom 15% and does not meet. There is, you know, some slight variation. They're not all perfect, tending to have something to do with that there are some clumps where students tend to cluster that make it so that we can't have a perfect distribution. But in general, the results for English language arts and math are pretty consistent. Oh! We didn't have this conversation yet. So, this year we're doing something really fun in Colorado. Okay, so we have been calculating growth from the old TCAP results onto the new PARC assessment.
Just to understand what it looks like and what it's used, right? Like,
I don't know what I'm going to do with it yet, or what we're going to do with it yet. I'm actually still in the process, like I'm still working with Damien and the Center for Assessment to sort of get all this finalized, but I wanted to include it so we at least have some idea of what we were looking at in this presentation. But we've taken sort of like the 2013 and the 2014 TCAP results and looked at how students, you know, did on PARC in 2015. And for the most part, things are looking pretty good, actually. Like it's
good meaning consistent.
Good meaning consistent.
So what we'll do is take that data once Marie looks a little bit deeper, go to the technical advisory panel for longitudinal growth, share it with them, get their recommendation on if and how it should be used and put out for this year. So
is that scale scores that you're talking about between those two tests?
Yes.
Are you doing anything like that with ACT and SAT?
So we. But with ACT, we have not generally run growth on that assessment, so we haven't done that previously, but we could do something where we are looking at sort of the percentile ranks on where schools and districts fell on the old ACT and as we transition to the new SAT. Because generally what I have found is that even though the scales have changed, even with PARC, sort of, honestly, it is still a bell curve, and the students who are sort of, you know, high flyers and low liers still tend to fall at the same places on the new assessments. So we can do something like that.
And is it down to the individual student?
Yeah. It looks at individual
so
students.
So if I was a parent and I said, you know, I had three other kids that did the ACT, you can do the scaled on the SAT.
Just
for clarification, I think what you were asking about is something slightly different, which is really, is there a way for us to come up with a table that will have, if you scored this on an ACT test, this is what you could expect to score on the SAT test, and vice versa. The answer to that is yes. Those tables should be available in June.
So when we're talking about this here, this is a similar thing that we're talking about with comparing PARC and CMAS, was it?
Yeah. It's a little bit different in that it's looking at the same kid on the different, so if you had a kid that took the third grade TCAP, the fourth grade TCAP, and then the fifth grade PARC, you would look at their history from those three.
And they're similar.
And then,
as a group.
Yeah, and then it's looking at the growth that they made, and it's taking all that history and doing the growth percentiles based on
it
that.
Should be.
Yeah, and we're seeing consistent data.
Okay.
But
So I apologize for not clarifying earlier, because we also have created a set of reports that are the percentile comparison reports that looking at the cohort of fifth graders who took TCAP, the cohort of fifth graders who took PARC, you know, for a school, how did those results compare? And that is different from these growth results that we're looking at here, where you're tracking a single cohort of students from grades 4, 5, and then 6 into PARC. So we have looked at the assessments both ways, and if we were to do ACT to SAT, it would be sort of in that first percentile comparison measure. But there is also a possibility that we've been talking about with once we have PSAT to do PSAT to SAT, and we could do growth for that. And you know, like there's a lot of options that will be potentially available to us.
Thank you.
And so I think, yeah, we're ready to move on to post-secondary and workforce readiness targets. So the PWR measures tend to be less consistent and a little, each one has to sort of be taken and considered on its own. And there have been changes in time in the calculation guidance and sort of the reported results that we've seen from the field. So we felt that now, as we're changing targets for all of the other metrics, this is a good time to revisit the PWR targets as well. We do recommend that we retain the targets for the Colorado ACT for one more year, because we are planning on transitioning to the SAT, so I don't spend a lot of time and resources sort of renorming that this year. But we are recommending that we relook at the targets for dropout rate and graduation rate. And then we will need to set new targets for the new measures of matriculation rate and then PSAT and SAT in the future when we have those results.
Matriculation rate in college?
So matriculation rate is a composite of two-year college enrollment, four-year college enrollment, and then CTE program enrollment. And then
in Colorado.
It also includes National Clearinghouse results. So we're working with the Department of Higher Education to get that matriculation rate, and yes, it does have the Student Clearinghouse results. So it doesn't include like every single college in the United States, but it's a much better representation than just the Colorado schools.
And do the districts collect this data and then report it, or are we doing it?
We'll do it for them.
Do the districts have the opportunity to look at the results that you get district by district to verify?
I think, maybe you could have to have a district, sorry to put you guys on the spot. Do you get the data from higher ed on enrollment numbers? Do you ever get to look at?
Summary data a year later.
Okay, a year later.
Some districts actually kind of keep track of their students.
Yeah, and
more and more I've noticed.
And some districts right now have their own contracts with National Clearinghouse to get it, but it's costly. But I know that there's some districts that do that. We were trying to see if our state contract would allow us to share that with them, so we need to figure out the data sharing agreement. Clearly, the districts will get the summary data that's in that performance frameworks back from us, and then we'll have to figure out what individual data they can get.
Okay. We'd love to have it. Absolutely.
Okay.
Does concurrent enrollment play into one of those categories somehow yet?
It does not currently.
Except if a student finishes. Like, so one thing that we're trying to make sure is if a student graduates high school with an associate's degree, that they would get credit because they may go straight to the workforce. The school should get credit in their matriculation rate that they already did that for their student during high school, right? That they didn't need to go on to a two-year college because they already completed that. But it's not, but if they've just taken a certain number of concurrent enrollment classes, we don't currently have that in the frameworks. It's something we're looking into. The concerns we've heard is not everybody has equal access in the state. And so if you put a measure on there that kids don't have equal access to, so we're looking at ways, how can we reward that or recognize it? Or you have a menu of options for districts that have different areas of focus.
Remediation rates, districts get those, right?
Yes, we do.
Do you get this full statewide report?
Yes.
Or now, and your
we've
district?
Got that for a period of about 5 years. Yeah.
That's being developed by your school. Is that going to the National Clearinghouse too, or not?
No. I don't think. Remediation is just from Colorado schools.
It's Colorado. I mean, the data I'm talking about is just Colorado data. But kids yeah. that leave the state, we don't have a way of tracking that now.
Yeah.
But it would not include any information. Remediation is needed by a student who's out of Colorado, outside of Colorado's systems. True. No information on
that. We have no information on that.
And isn't their matriculation rate relatively new?
It was just added by the legislature last spring, so this will be the first time it's in the framework.
Hey,
yeah, you got it.
And then one last quickie. Completion rate. Do you report based on a four-year, basic four-year attainment?
We have some slides actually to discuss that in more detail because it's an excellent question. In addition, like the four-year rate and then also the completion rate, which can include GED. So we've had a lot of conversations with our stakeholders about that in the past year. But first, we're going to talk about ACT real fast, where I'm just saying we're just keeping the previous targets and we'll update once we have SAT data. And then, so the next, just sort of looking at the trends that we've seen in Colorado since the targets for graduation rate and dropout rate were set in 2009-2010, you can see that there has been, a very steady, noticeable increase over time in graduation rate and sort of a significant drop in dropout rate. And so we are looking to potentially reset those targets so that we can make sure that we actually have ambitious yet attainable expectations for school and district improvement, because I would say that as time has gone on, everybody has become, meets or exceeds. And that means that they're not quite as meaningful as they were when we initially set them, so we're looking at renorming those.
You know off the top of your head, with these trends in graduation dropout rates appear national trends, exceed national trends, below national trends.
Grad rate is similar. Grad rate's been increasing nationally over time. I don't know about dropout rate, though.
We presume that one would...
They're related.
Yeah.
Not completely. At least dropout in Colorado starts with 7th graders, so we look at 7th through 12th, and it's an annual dropout rate. So it's not like 100% they're either graduate or dropout, and it adds up, but they are similar.
Mm-hmm. And so for dropout, there was also a change in the way Colorado calculated and reported dropout rate that happened in
12-13.
Okay.
That's what I'm assuming from the big job.
So, that's another reason that with that new definition, we probably want to look at renorming. So when we are proposing sort of use that 15th, 50th, 85th percentile cuts again, and I just like to make pictures. So you can see that with dropout rate in particular, there's it's very skewed. Like the vast majority of schools and districts have very low graduation rates, and then there's sort of like a
dropout rate.
Sorry, and then there's sort of a trailing tentacle of schools, small number of school and districts that have higher dropout rates.
But just so you see that big spike right there at 0%, there's a huge, almost 20% of schools, right? Right?
Maybe yes.
Right? Have 0% of students dropping out. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's changed over time. So.
Well, the latest national data are called dropout factors.
Yeah.
And I think it's about a 6 to 7 year span. Considerable drop in the number of those schools that are not producing graduates. And, so
nationally, the trend is looking good.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and there with 20% of our schools having not a single dropout in the last year, like, that is actually really impressive.
And how big are those schools?
They actually do vary, because I had the same question. I actually went and looked. And while, yes, a lot of them are small, there are quite a few that have hundreds of students. I think the largest one had 644 students, and not a single student dropped out. And, or was reported as a dropout in the last year, because I had the same question. I wanted to know. Yeah. I was quite impressed, actually. I was like, wow. Yes. And then so graduation rate. So what we have traditionally presented for the performance frameworks has been the best of graduation rate. So we would look at a school's 4, 5, 6, and 7 year rate, and then give them whichever one gave them the best results. So if we renorm the targets sort of with current data, we would recommend applying sort of the 15, 50, 85th percentile targets. We have had a lot of conversations about completion rate versus graduation rate, and looking at the consequences of switching that. So the answer, at this point, my recommendation is that adding completer rate or changing to completer rate does not actually benefit the majority of traditional schools. It's very important for alternative education campuses, and they already are allowed to use completer rate. But for traditional schools, they don't get a lot of bang for their buck. And with the lowered expectations that for the GED that are coming up, I have concerns about thinking that completer rate and graduation rate are truly comparable. So I would recommend that we continue using just graduation rate.
We had gotten, Oliver, if you want to talk to it, feedback from the accountability work group that said, let's look at using the completer rate instead. That's when those expectations for the GED were raised. And now that they've decided to go back and lower those down again, we have some concerns. Historically, the U.S. Department of Ed has not looked at completer rate as an allowable measure. They want the graduation rate. That, who knows what will happen in the future. It says graduation rate still. It's definitely something we can negotiate, but with that lower GED expectation now, I think that was a concern for us about going forward with completer instead of grad. And we've got some really, I mean, you saw that trend, grad rates have really been increasing over time. When we implement grad guidelines, we'll definitely want to look at the distribution again and think about, because it may change things.
Yeah.
Real quick, I have no idea what the percentage is of kids who graduate early. And this is where the concurrent enrollment and the change in, you know, we always look to the future when assessments can be given when ready. And, you know, keep track of all that. But there are kids who have graduated before their cohort, their 4-year cohort date. Are they counted, or do they completely get?
So there is a 3-year graduation rate that CDE collects. And we don't, at the moment, we're not counting that for performance frameworks. So the students who graduate in 3 years are included in the 4-year graduation cohort because they're sort of
lumped
in. And the 5 and the 6, exactly. But there's not currently, like, you don't get a bonus for graduating students within 3 years. Generally, there hasn't been a large enough number of students in any given school or district to really make it worthwhile looking at a 3-year completer rate, at least not that we've seen it at a big system level.
That's where our weed patch is. You know, we're either the tall weeds or we have to talk down at the bottom. But I'm thinking if a school within the district conversation is at, what's the word? It's not repeal.
Request for reconsideration.
In a small district, maybe particularly, if that early graduate was included in that year's accountability.
From the year before.
Somewhere, someday, it might be interesting to see if that impacts the overall achievement in the graduation rate category. Probably not very often.
But I'm sure there's an occasion that it would.
There's always one.
It always happens. Yeah.
Getting the whole real picture as much as you're having.
Yeah. So the thing that we have sort of been looking at more is, admittedly, the four-year graduation rate. And this sort of is more in alignment with sort of federal statute and some of the expectations for on-time graduating. And so we've also run the data to see what would it look like if we set sort of the 15, 50, and 85, you know, cuts based upon just the four-year graduation targets. And then the next slide sort of gives the impact data, you know, when applying these targets for schools and districts. Actually, I apologize. This is the slide of targets.
Yeah.
The next one is the impact data.
And this one, just so you guys all can see, like, the exceeds target for dropout previously has been 1%. With this, it would move to 0% just because that's what we've seen. There's so many schools with a 0% dropout rate now.
And in the same way that if you look at the best of graduation rate, previously the expectation for meeting this meet state expectations was at 80%. Based upon the new distribution, it's at 93.9%. So there's been a pretty significant shift. If you look at the four-year graduation rates, the targets would be 67%, 85%, and 95%, which is closer to what we previously had, and in line with some stuff about ESSA that I'm sure we'll get to talk about one of these days. But just sort of knowing that, you know, being clear that in a normative system, as the system has improved, our targets will continue to go up.
Unless you think you're already where you want to be, right? Like, you went, if you were already at 95 and you thought that was good enough, you could leave it there. But if you wanted to differentiate, you know, then you want to move it up.
Yep.
That's what Elena's going to talk about next.
That's the criteria.
And just the matriculation, we don't have all the data quite pulled together yet. We just finalized the data sharing agreement with Department of Higher Ed for all of it. But once we do it, the proposal is to look at the 50th and 85th cut score of that rate. But we've got to dig into it and really understand what those numbers look like.
Yeah. And so now you can see the impact data. And so based upon what we're seeing here, like, again, since we've set these at the 15th, 50th, and 85th, we can see that it's pretty consistent. There are, you know, situations like Alyssa had talked about for graduation and dropout rate where we have a significant number of students who are at 0% dropout. So they kind of cluster in that exceeds category, but there's really no way to differentiate between, like, zero is as low as you can go. There's no way to parse that out more. But, you know, this information is meaningful for our ability from the framework perspective to sort of identify schools that are systematically low performing and schools that are systematically high performing across indicators so that we can, you know, eventually decide what their performance framework rating overall should be. So I think that's everything we had about that. Oh, that didn't mean to come at the end. Sorry. Matriculation rate. We'd already talked about it, so this is just sort of saying, you know, laying out everything that we've discussed previously about CTE enrollment, 2- and 4-year college enrollment, and that we're working on getting the data.
Mm-hmm. So you guys want to breathe for a minute. we wanted just to have a little time for you to hear about some other methods, talking about criteria reference mainly, and talk briefly about the previous target, if that would be helpful just to get the whole lay of the landscape of different options. That sound okay?
Mm-hmm.
You're
still
hanging in there, all right? Okay.
Because ultimately, that's the discussion. I mean, it's not that's this transition time, but ultimately, that's the conversation. If we're talking about competency-based learning.
Okay.
At some point, we've got to put things that are consistent.
It depends on your purposes, right? And like what you're trying to do and what you're trying to do where. But yes, it would align. Criteria reference align. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think the only reason why I'm really here is because Marie wanted a break. Okay. So I'm going to be talking about this criterion reference approach, but I think it's really important to keep in mind that even though we're talking about criteria, in the background, you're still kind of operating in some type of a normative framework. And that's important because this example that is in your handout, the cut score primer, says it quite nicely, which is no student set a cut score or target that required students to run a mile in 3 minutes to be classified as proficient, right, in PE. So there's an existence proof concept that's really key here. That is, you've got to see this. It has to be observable. It has to be believable in order for you to set that cut at, say, proficient. Same thing, I think we have the analog in NCLB, right, with 100% as a target for 2014. That's long gone. It's something that wasn't attainable, but yet that's something that was set, and it became, there was a lot of backlash as a result of that. And so ultimately, these cut scores are based using criteria that's informed by what people can do. So that's where the normative framework does come in mind. But the thing that is important to distinguish is that once you fix, say, a standard to the distribution, and you're no longer making comparisons, right, explicit comparisons about how students perform against other students or how schools perform to other schools, then you're kind of moving away from this normative-based approach. Some of the advantages is, I think the key point is that it involves quite a lot of stakeholders. That is, content experts specifically, those who are deeply knowledgeable about, say, the indicators and an accountability framework, are the types of folks that come around the table and help inform where should the standards be relative to what they believe are values or expectations that should be defining each of those cuts. So those cuts have meanings. And I think this leads to the second point, which is it leads to a more transparent way, at least in terms of being able to communicate what that criteria means relative to the standards. So it's not just a score that compares, but it's also a way in which you're saying these are descriptors, these are success criteria, these are expectations that we have at each of these different levels, and that's the meaning behind each and every single one of those targets or those performance levels. And so it becomes more user-friendly also to a broad set of, say, users or stakeholders or constituents who can better understand what it means to be at that performance level. I think everyone around the table can probably, is very familiar with all of these challenges. So I think the first point is probably the biggest one, is that the criteria are developed, but all of this is based on human judgment. Even though this is informed by experts and people who are deeply knowledgeable about the content, you know, these things can certainly be filtered by personal agendas, biases, certainly by some political agendas as well. And so this can certainly influence where the targets are set, how criteria are defined. There are quite a few standard setting methods or target setting methods that could be used. And depending on which set of methods you use, you can have different results. So I think it's important to state here is that you're not wedded to just one, say, method. In fact, people do use, say, different types of approaches and compare them. But I'll get to the fourth point. It becomes really resource intensive and very costly just to even do one round. So the third piece is really important because when you're always getting people together in a room, it's kind of like herding cats. You need to make sure that the process itself is tightly organized. And that's not an easy thing to do. And it has to be facilitated by a person who's deeply knowledgeable about the various methods. Why? Because that person has to train every single panelist around the room so that they can deeply engage in and meaningfully participate in the standard setting method that's been chosen. So this fourth point is important. It's not trivial at all because when you think about it, say we have 12 raters or 12 panelists in a room, and say it takes about 2 days for us to set a performance target on, say, just one indicator. So think about how that could increase exponentially when you think about all of the different indicators that are in the framework. And then you have to think about all the materials that need to be gathered, as well as all the staff that need to be there in order to attend every single standard setting session. So this type of process, even though there are certain, I would say, advantages, it is very resource intensive and costly. Just to give a very high level, just general process of how this approach works, the first piece is critical because there's a lot of time spent at the forefront just training, getting panelists to understand what's the meaning behind this work and what is the process and how do you engage in this meaningfully. And so sometimes what you'll do is you'll have dry runs so that people understand, oh, okay, this is what you mean when you say I'm a borderline student and you're asking me for the probability of that student being successful. Being able to really engage in that takes some practice, and so this first piece is really important. Second piece, incredibly important, and this is this idea of being sure that everyone can define the criteria for each of those performance levels and the descriptors. And so these are typically vetted and finalized before you get into the setting targets. So you have to be clear about what you're shooting for before you actually define where the cut should be. And then the third piece is then you go into the judgment ratings process and you engage in the standard setting process. And then the fourth point is important because it's not a one-shot deal. It's iterative. And so you certainly come together as a group later, you take a look at the results, and there are some adjustments that are made to the targets. The fifth one is equally important. It's all about communication and how you communicate the information about the targets, how they're set, and the performance expectations to stakeholders. We're not getting into the methods today. I think the handout actually does a nice job of just talking about the different types of methods that are out there, mainly for assessments, but there are certainly ways in which this could be done for accountability ratings as well. But again, this idea of there are clear disadvantages and advantages for any method that you choose. And of course, all methods are, I would say, encumbered, or also, well, not necessarily encumbered, but it involves human judgment. So there is no single correct target. I think that's a really key point here, because the targets are constructed. So they're not just found, but they have to be, they come together, people come together to actually construct meaning of the criteria, and they construct meaning about the target that's been set. Setting a bar higher or lowering expectations. This is actually a really important point, because you're saying, where do we set the cut, and do we give the benefit of the doubt, or do we set a more stringent criteria? I think that reflects some value. So to give a concrete example, when I was working with Hawaii, one of the big things that we were looking at is educator evaluation systems. And how do you set the cuts for some of the targets that have been set? And so I think the overwhelming feedback that we got from the field, as well as from even the board, was that we have to give the benefit of the doubt to educators. And for this reason, you know, we actually built in a margin of error. We didn't consider the top part. We just considered the lower part of the confidence interval. So we gave the benefit of the doubt to educators. I'm going to walk to, oh, yes. I'm going to walk through two just really simple examples, so it kind of brings this to life a little bit more with respect to, say, accountability. And I'm going to start with the second point, actually, because I think it's a little bit more concrete. So for Colorado, for ACT, this is something that Alyssa mentioned at the very beginning. The approaching target was set at 17. So CDE actually didn't do this job, but ACT did, and they looked at the scores that were most likely the kinds of scores that you would need to enter most Colorado community colleges, and that was 17. The same exercise was done for setting the target at 22 because that was considered to be more a score associated with student enrollment and more selective for your institutions. So that just gives you a sense. Now, going back to the first point, this is the process that I'll actually be involved with. For the first time in Nevada, they're going to be convening a group of stakeholders this summer, and we're going to be looking at the overall star ratings. So just to be clear, I know you're being asked to look at the sub-indicator and indicator level. They're not interested in that. They're more interested in the overall ratings and giving definition to that, because that's where they felt that it's really critical for stakeholders to understand what makes a 5-star rating school and how is that different from, say, a 4-star rating school. But they do want to do this relative to, say, CCR expectations. So that's the thing that's going to be interesting for how they're going to do this.
College and career ready.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We're PWR.
That's right. Yeah. Sorry about that. Acronyms. So I think this second piece, I have a link, which I think will be nice to take a look at. And this is Rhode Island did this, so did Utah. And what they did was they look at, this is called a profile approach, because what you do is you look at the entire profile of, say, schools. You look at, well, what do higher performing schools in general kind of look like? What are the key characteristics and features of those schools? You do the same kind of exercise for schools located at different performance levels. And so When you open this up,
don't look at how many samples.
And if you could scroll down, please. Yeah. So what you will see, so it's just clicked onto Warning Schools. And what you do see is, look, there's a descriptor there that tells you, if you're a warning school, that's how you kind of look like, right? You see that performance criteria that's pegged to it. And then what you also see is that the state as a whole looked across sub-indicators and said, in general, this is how you would likely perform on these different set of indicators. So if you click on to, say, focus schools, it's slightly different. So look at the performance criteria right under the title. So it's about substandard achievement in reading and math, unacceptable achievement gaps, and little or no academic progress in improving student achievement or increasing graduation rates. And then you see also, well, there are some criteria that they're looking at, additional criteria, in terms of how would those schools likely perform based on the subset of indicators there. So that just kind of gives, I think, a little bit of life to what I'm saying when they're looking at the profile of schools and trying to figure out what are the key features we want to draw out of it. Okay. And then New Jersey and Montgomery County, they went through a similar process of looking at profiles of teachers in order to determine what makes sense for defining the criteria and what makes sense then for defining the test. Okay. I think just to close this piece, to give you a sense of, you know, I think you have a sense that this is quite a heavy lift, especially to undertake in terms of defining criteria. So one thing to consider is, you know, for all 22 sub-indicators, that might be a tough lift, especially when you think about the time frame associated with having to set these indicators by, say, the fall. One thing that could be certainly considered and is using this type of approach for setting the final plan type rating. So instead of when you're looking at accreditation with improvement plan, going back to something that was raised earlier, then you have a clearer picture, perhaps, of a performance profile associated with that, so it gives rise to meaning. That is, there's more meaning behind what that plan type means to schools, to stakeholders, etc. Okay? And that pretty much wraps up the criteria piece.
I know. This last one is really quick, and then we can do conversation, discussion, or end if you all are done. We had heard from a district and a few stakeholders about the idea of using the previous targets. Specifically keeping the achievement targets where we had set based on CSAP, TCAP. And that suggestion came from a rationale of saying, well, we're saying to students and their families that our expectations have increased, right? And so kids that took TCAP in the past and now are taking CMAS, PARC, they're not necessarily seeing that same level of proficiency that they had in the past because our expectations have raised. So the idea would be to align those performance shifts with what we're messaging in the performance frameworks. If we renorm, we're going to renorm and only, again, have 15% that are really struggling and then another 35 and 15 at the top. If you kept it the same, the majority of schools and districts would be at does not meet an approaching, but that maybe aligns with the messaging of that we have new higher expectations. So it's an idea, I think it's an idea that we have concern about in terms of a sense of fairness and differentiating school and district performance, but it's a very solid idea in terms of being aligned with that message that we have higher expectations now. So we just wanted to share that with you since it was something that we had heard and wanted to make sure you all heard that as well. Challenges to that, I think one of the other challenges for us to that is that our previous targets were set on a normative distribution. They weren't set by criterion reference. We didn't say it had some meaning tied to something else. And so because it was previously set by a norm, how does that norm carry over to a new assessment? So that's one of those challenges there. And again, it would mostly describe our schools and districts as not meeting or approaching state expectations in terms of achievement, and that wouldn't allow us that same level of differentiation that we may, that's helpful to have at least when we're trying to figure out who to learn from and where to celebrate things and where we really want to focus and prioritize supports.
So I'm guessing the districts that want us to stay the same are not the ones that are
going to be tanking?
I wouldn't say that. I think it was more of a policy conceptual idea that came, where it came from. It came from one district, but I've also heard it from a few other people, that it's just floating out there. I think we were just trying to put out all the possible ideas that we have.
I guess we feel clear to communicate what it is that we do and how it's different from what we had before.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
So next steps, well, we would love any questions or follow-up. I think we've got, from you, Dr. Flores, some good ideas about going in and looking a little bit deeper. We'll want to do some more additional data analysis as data becomes available, both on matriculation rate and then PSAT sometime this summer and SAT a year. We'll need the board to approve targets for the fall 2016 release. So when we put those out, we're aiming for September. Usually those go out in August in normal years. We're just, with still new data coming in and adjusting, we're just saying September for those. We would like to have some indication from you all in the sense, because we're putting those spring reports out for the districts, just for them to get a sense and understand, it would be helpful, I think, for them to know where those targets would be. So if we can do that this spring, at least for some of them, that would be great. If we need to have more time to research and evaluate, we do have time until the fall. Till September, I should say, to do that, or before September, because we need time to go out then. And then again, as we get the new data next year, we really want to look at the targets. We'll want to look and see what 50th percentile is in 16 data compared to 15, same with 85th and 15th, and really see how things have changed over time, and we'll bring that to you all. So any thoughts or questions or things you all would like us to do or send some timeline from you would be helpful.
What you're asking for on Wednesday is...
So we were going to ask you to vote on Wednesday, and then we dug in and dug in and dug in and thought there might be some questions and concerns here, and then we thought maybe Wednesday is a little soon and that we should wait till April. But I think there's some other ideas that we should spend some time investigating. We can talk more on Wednesday. We could take it off the agenda for Wednesday. We wanted to get a sense from you all of how you were feeling about this and then make
what
a decision.
What you're asking us to vote on specifically is the norming. Norming the 2016 results.
I think we'd say norm the 2015 results and use those for the targets for 16. Yeah. Right. And I think that's where we landed. You know, all of these have pros and cons. I think where we landed, like Marie said, is on the doing norm reference and using the school distribution. Not perfect. I think it's probably the best solution for going forward, but I think we should look at some other options too. And maybe that's what we do. We look at that. We get you some information in the meantime, vote and see where that leads. And if there's something promising there, we could go deeper into that. Or if we think we just want to go with norms, we can go with norms and do that in April. We just wanted a sense from you all of what felt right, what you wanted more information on. It's detailed and it's important in terms of the messaging and where we want schools and districts to pay attention. When they're doing their UIP, they really do go look and see where there's red and orange for digging in and paying more attention. Also for blue, I always tell them, go look at where your blue is and green to see where you're succeeding, because that's, you can learn a lot from where you're doing well. So it gives them that kind of sense for improvement planning. So it's important that we pay attention to that. But again, these don't in and of themselves determine that final distribution, the final rating of schools, and that's another conversation that we'll all get to have together. Maybe not on a Friday afternoon.
With one.
Yeah. Is that within the last one?
This lines up with on the clock decisions we have to make next summer. So is this, what's released in the
fall
is a reflection of where we are now.
15-16 school year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Includes this spring's.
It'll be this spring's. Yeah.
So what's on the calendar? Next round is in the fall of 2017. Spring. Well, fall. So are our decisions, our imminent decisions in the summer of 2017?
Yeah.
Will
include this data?
Coming up years.
Yeah.
Not.
No, it'll include that.
In time for spring of 2017.
Correct. It's the 20. So, and we'll talk about this on Wednesday in more detail. We've got a timeline for you all. But we have 30, but now 29, because when school closed, 29 schools that have already entered year 5. So per law, you need to direct an action with the hold by June 30th, 2017. We would suggest that you would want to look at these new ratings. Even though they've already entered year five, if they come off, if they move to improvement or performance and no longer priority improvement or turnaround, you wouldn't need to take an action because they've already come off the way
that
makes sense.
That's real. That's all right. I needed to be okay. Assured of is what's coming up in the next year going to be in their bank of presentation.
Yeah, we'll make
sure. So
and that's one thing we'll talk, because we're going to recommend, I think it makes sense to wait until those ratings are final before you start hearing from districts, unless districts want to come forward on their own, because there's a few that have said, we want to come forward, we want to present our plan. We think having them do that before November makes sense, but we think after, if we start in November, December timeline, we think it'll be tight, and that's where we want to talk with you all about, that we can get them all through by June. 2017. You're going to have a lot of work to do. Sorry. You need a raise.
What if we thought about even adding something like Nate? I was just, in fact, I sent out an article by an economist, educator at Stanford, who really has looked at NAEP and has found, you know, these states who consistently do well. One of them, of course, we all know, Massachusetts. And they have been kind of going along with those NAEP scores. We know that Texas is doing better in math. And we could even look, according to him, we could even look at factors within states that are more like us, and then look at what they're doing, really investigate what they're doing and why their kids are doing better. Let's say our limited English proficient kids. Let's say Texas is doing better in math than ours here. What is Texas doing then to get better scores in math than for limited English proficient kids than we are in Colorado.
In terms of understanding performance and
exactly.
Practice.
And something that, you know, the scores are
thing is just not, it's not directly part of the accountability right? You're talking just about
no, I'm not talking about an idea. I'm talking about the idea that we have made and that every state has made. And
in terms of being able to learn about our system. So it's more about learning about our system and policies and best practices.
Right, that it's not a measure that we can use in Colorado district by district.
Correct.
I'm trying to figure out.
That's right. We can't, but we might. We might be able to if we use NAEP. If we use NAEP as opposed to... as opposed to the other measure.
The idea is to give it a, rather than use it as a sample, make it the exam itself.
Yeah,
it could. Okay, well, never mind.
Yeah, it's not
seems like a good
it's
idea.
It's not what, you can't get it all together. Yeah. And why not? I mean, Massachusetts did their test, their own test, according to their own test. Yes, based on NAEP. And I believe that that's why they're where they are.
So you're suggesting that we change our test so it looks like a NAEP test. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Well, I mean, that's what the feds want. The feds,
so
that's a criterion used for everybody. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So when folks talk about aligning their system to NAEP, in most cases what they have done is one of two things. One is they have taken their fourth and eighth grade test and they've embedded some NAEP questions into that, and then they use that information. Or they utilize the NAEP performance as one of those external factors to consider during the standard setting. Similar to what we've done with some of our other standards. NAEP does not exist in grades 3, 5, 6, 7, or 9. Historically, it is sampled across states, so very few districts get district-level results. school level results are even harder. Individual student level results are even harder. Now, again, I think it makes sense to say that we could learn as a state.
That's right.
Oh, look, this other state with a similar population is doing something differently, and as a state,
right,
this is what we're going to do. But in terms of district utility or school utility, that would be much more difficult unless you apply that
right.
state learning.
But as a whole, we do want to help those kids that are not succeeding. I mean,
what
those
did
kids
Florida do to expand?
May I just finish? It is important that we learn about kids who are not doing well, and we need to work with that population so that they will do better. It's not fair to just look at kids who are performing and doing well and giving awards to those kids and just think, oh, well, we'll always have that population with us. Let's not worry about them. And I think we need to look as a system mm-hmm. as to what other states are doing so that we are able to have data, have information, and do something about those populations that need the help. We do need to do that.
Thank you.
What did Florida do in terms of getting more feedback from me? Do you remember?
In math, they do look.
I would actually need to go and look specifically. I know that Florida has some what we refer to as TUDA districts, and those are districts who participate enough to actually get district level results. And again, I would need to look more carefully to see what else it is that we have done.
A lot of times, but we need to know what it would cost, even if it's just fourth and eighth grade, what's involved in getting more data than usual, once every 2 year sample.
And Florida and Texas are two states that are doing better in math. And with that population.
When we got the, I don't know at what point, part, it might have been field test, but I think it was just results, and you spoke to us a little bit about how you had looked at how there were among, it was not only NAEP that was in that group, it's another SBC. Smarter Balanced, did you look at that a little bit? But anyway, just to see where the park measure and our results fit in with other, I mean, those were Colorado results, I think, right? And maybe some national ones, but.
Before we break up, let me ask, you all asked a specific question, I know some are getting ready to leave. Do we want this on the agenda? Are we ready to make a decision at this upcoming March mm-hmm. meeting?
How about yes on the agenda, but maybe not voting?
Okay. Joyce?
I have a couple questions that I would like answered in the March meeting.
Okay, great.
Number one, is this all required? All of this? Is it required federally, statewide? I just want to know what the requirements are for this. And the second thing I'd like to know is, if this is something we're going to vote on, I would like to see this, and I'm not sure if this is the format, sent out to all the superintendents of my district, and I would like their input as if they're a stakeholder to be sent back, and I want that divided into my congressional, just because it's very rural, and I want to see what their thoughts are. And if I sent this to them, I would hope they would have some semblance of understanding, but if not, it might have to be pared down a little differently, but they're the ones that are going to have to explain that to parents, and this is not, we're not too early to start on that.
I sent the notice of this meeting and the link to the PowerPoint to all of our accountability contacts, so there's one for each district, and probably most of yours, it's probably the superintendent already, also to some of our stakeholder groups too. We can do some more. I think what will be most helpful for those schools and districts to be able to respond is maybe to see their data in it, which is what we're trying to do this spring. But that makes it a hard timing, so maybe we'll think through if there's some options for you all say, let's look at it this way. I don't I don't know, we'll have to think about
provisional,
like, yeah, provisional, or like we get a nod from you to do it, and then we send them their data like that and get feedback, because that's what we've been trying to do with the spring reports, is that they could see their data in there. We'll collect feedback over the summer and see if we need to change anything before the official
fall report.
I really
like buy-in like that, yeah, specifically to their district, to let them, because it comes out and we vote on it, and then they say, well, what's this all about?
Absolutely. And we mostly just talked when Elliot and I went around the state in the fall and talked to all the superintendent groups about some of the recommendations. What we heard loud and clear there and talked to them about was having a single set of targets for school and district, and that's what they really wanted. But again, when you start seeing it and what the impact is, then that's another thing. So that's why we want to get them their data. And if we can get an indication from you all of go this path and give them their data with that path, then I think we can get some good feedback. So thank you.
Jane, do you want to?
Well, along with that, the communication, we do have some districts that are really, what they do is they do things criterion-based. And, you know, I would ask Westminster if you all have had input into this conversation.
I participated in the accountability group, but I'm working on accountability 3.0.
So, you know, answer to that. So, thank you. But that's my quick one. Just all I need is a yes or no from Joyce that we did talk about NAEP in relation to how it could be, it calibrates in a comparable way. We could get some information to base some decision making on by looking at it. We're not talking about what the test would be. We're talking about
So whenever we have had a conversation about setting cut scores, we have referenced NAEP and how NAEP compares to our suggested cut scores. Yes, we have done that.
So do you have enough guidance in? Anybody on the phone?
Yeah.
Anybody on
the phone? If we're to be successful, good.
Okay, so you put it on the agenda at least for an information item?
Okay. Right.
Okay. All right.
I agree.
Okay. All right. Does that give you the guidance that you need?
It does. Thank you all so much for your time on Friday afternoon. We really appreciate it.
Right.
I know this
is
a deep nap, and
yeah.
Well, we appreciate you all taking the 5 extra time to do it, because I know another ask on top of your.
Good idea.
Thank you.
We can come signing off.
Bye.
Thank you.